We'll have the heat turned down in a few minutes. So that everyone will be as comfortable as possible. We have an interesting subject this morning that we all more or less accept and think about, but very often we don't do very much of anything about it. It's a little too far from the machine. Well, I'm still fighting a cold, so I'll have to move up a little on the machine. Is that going to be better? Okay. The body in its relation to the person that lives in it is very much like a house, the old family homestead. And we forget very often that the person and the house represent two completely separate principles, two parts of a compound. And the relationship between the body and the person living in it is one of the most important in all of the study of humanity. The house is something that is built and composed not of inert material, but of living substance. The body is not stone. It is self-renewing, self-generating, self-restoring in many ways and parts, and at the same time, it is something we have to protect and guard. The relationship begins when we realize that the person is an individual entity, and that its entrance into the material world through the body is entering a house. The person exists prior to the body. The person survives the body. The person continues down through the ages, according to at least some philosophical systems, to create new bodies, and to build into each body the experiences of previous building, so that theoretically, each body that we build should bear witness to the degree of internal integration we have achieved. The body is very much like the house in another particular, and that is, it requires upkeep. We have a tendency to assume that the body takes care of itself. And we do the same thing with it that we often do with a fine home. We neglect it. If we have a nice house and we do not manage it well, it will gradually deteriorate. If we do not combine our bodily function with a plan of management, the body gradually loses its vitality. Everyone knows about the house they have entered at some time during their lifetime, a house of a friend. The yard is beautifully kept up, the house is well painted, but inside of the house there is neglect. This neglect seemingly is due to the fact that the person feels that if the outside looks right, if they keep it well painted and the garden well weeded, the neighbors will think well of them. And very few people are going to see the neglect inside of the house. This is true also in the body situation. Very often we spend considerable time, effort, money in maintaining the outward appearance of a body, but we neglect its inner needs. We are much more aware of taking care of the cosmetic aspects of the body than we are of maintaining its internal health. The attitude seems to be that if we protect the surface, the rest takes care of itself. This is not true. We also find that it is sometimes convenient to bring in cleaning agencies or carpenters or builders to repair and restore damage inside of a house, such as neglected plumbing or wiring. We do the same thing with the body. We bring in experts on various fields when the body gives us serious difficulties. We use the physician, the physiotherapist, the dietitian to take care of troubles appearing within the body itself. But for the most part, we drift along assuming that the body will stand a tremendous amount of punishment, and because of this assumption, we continue to punish it every day. Now, it is much better as we think along to realize that this commonwealth of the flesh, which is our temporary home, is part of our karmic and cosmic responsibilities. The individual who believes that he has to grow and unfold his religious and psychological potentials must also take responsibilities for the things that are his in this world. Many people go out trying to be spiritual. They neglect their families. They neglect their homes. Very often they assume that the larger dedication liberates them from the daily responsibilities of maintenance. This is not true. There is no more important aspect of religion than the individual taking care of those things that have been entrusted to him, or over which he has taken a voluntary management. So in the case of the body, it is not only important to realize that there are spiritual centers in the body, there are meditative factors that can be stimulated, there are extrasensory perceptions and all these things. But in this quest of these higher values, we must be very careful not to overlook the need of the plumbing and the wiring and the daily house cleaning. The moment we begin to neglect the body, it begins to react adversely. And it is our problem and our proper duty to keep the harmony between the body and the mind in every possible way. The mind, in its own turn, is very largely supported by an instrument which we call the brain. The brain is physical. The brain is something that depends for its function upon the maintenance of the physical body. The moment the physical body is damaged, the possibility of interference with mental and emotional processes increases. We have to maintain the body in order to use the mind. Now, in the course of years, I've come across a great many people who have allowed a deterioration of their physical living to impair their minds. They are persons of fair capacities. They are persons who could have done something with their lives, but due to more or less neglect or complete indifference to the basic problems of mind-body relationships, they have found themselves in a dangerous situation, and what should have been a wonderful partnership ended in ruin. We have to recognize, for example, the common failing of our day, alcoholism. The effect of alcoholism on the body is obvious, and nothing can affect the body like alcoholism that does not also affect the mind. It affects the entire life. It interferes with every objective and purpose of human existence. And unless this is controlled, the individual is in serious trouble. There are many other habits which have to be variously regenerated, redeemed, and reorganized in order to maintain the bodily health. So we might say, for generally speaking at least, that the body is a kind of a pedestal on which stands the person. Everything we want to do on the higher levels of life depends upon certain biological, biochemical adjustments. Where the body is uncomfortable, the person is unhappy. where bodily conditions are irritated, the temperament is irritated. And where the body is allowed to become discouraged, the person in the body suffers discouragement. Most of the mental and emotional attitudes that we have arise from physical inconveniences of one kind or another. These inconveniences may, some of them, be deliberate callousness. Others may be the result of circumstances comparatively beyond our control. But the basic truth remains that the body is very important, and that the individual who sacrifices his health must have a very great and important thing to do to justify this sacrifice. Because if he does sacrifice it, regardless of his motives or intentions, the bodily harmony will be interfered with. Now, we know in most cases that we have disciplines for the development of the mind and the control of the emotions. These disciplines mean a great deal to the average individual, particularly now. And there are hundreds of schools springing up, large and small, old and new, relating to disciplines of enlightenment. Disciplines intended to expand the consciousness of the person, to enlarge and ennoble character, and even to develop extrasensory perceptions and psychic faculties. Nearly all of these processes that are worth the name require very strong and stern self-discipline. Anything that is promised without effort is worth about what the lack of effort is worth. There is no way of winning any extension of ability without dedication of purpose. So the person begins various disciplines. He practices yoga or Zen. He meditates and contemplates and performs retrospective disciplines. And to a certain measure, he tries to keep the body in reasonable condition. But the moment he starts to meditate or use any of these higher faculties, he is likely to come into conflict with the body. Now, the reason why this happens is that in a great many people, the body has been spoiled. It is a spoiled child, and like such a child, is very difficult to manage and resents any interference with the habit mechanisms which it has built up. These habit mechanisms of the body are apt to be negative, like the habit mechanisms of the mind and emotions. But the person attempting to settle down quietly to the cultivation of his inner life is subject to constant minor annoyances from the body. He sits down, he relaxes, he gets into the perfect mood, and something itches. Then he quietly gets past this point for a little while, and all of a sudden he remembers something. He remembers something that he should have taken care of and did not, or he remembers the phone call he ought to have made, or he remembers a promise that was broken. One thing or another comes in to interfere with this quiet meditative process. Then, as meditation with the average person to start with is very apt to end in sleep, he thinks he is disciplining himself beautifully, and the next thing you know, he's sound asleep. And I know one case in which a yogi here in Los Angeles, publicly speaking, in a large auditorium, seated himself on a table in the middle of the stage, entered meditation and went fast asleep and fell off the table. Normally speaking, this might have interfered with his reputation, but it did not. It really enhanced it. It was decided that he was in such deep meditation that he actually almost ascended from the table. But he ascended downward instead of upward. So sleep comes along. Fatigue, hunger, worry, interruptions of one kind or another, a little street noise. All kinds of things interfere. Many of these interferences are the result of the acuteness of the sensory perceptions. which have been trained to respond to certain stimuli. Others come merely from lack of correct exercising or posturing. The individual will find that meditative postures begin by being rather painful. The body aches when muscles are used differently. But altogether, the main problem with the meditation is that the body, the personality, the environment, the neighborhood, the actual house in which we physically live, all these interfere with quietude. They make it almost impossible for the individual to remain at peace. Now, the body has this type of problem also, somewhat due probably to dietetic and nutritional intake. A large part of the food that we take discomforts the body. It tries to let us know, but we simply take some kind of a digestive pill and keep right on going. We overeat, we undereat. We do all kinds of things that affect the body's peace of mind. And the body seems to have a little mind of its own. And as a result of that, when we call upon the body to make a little more constructive effort than usual, we very often find it unable to do so or unwilling to do so. So when we start trying to be better people, we have to begin with basics. And one of the basic factors we all have to face is the body. Now, there is a two-way relationship involved here. There is not only the relation of the person to his body, but the relation of the body to the person himself. Sometimes one interferes with the other. Sometimes both interfere with each other. But to begin with, the most probably elementary and basic situation is to try to get the body into partnership with the purposes of the individual. The person must decide what his problems are, what his objectives are, what he wants to accomplish. And having decided these things, he must bring his body into the partnership. One of the problems of the body is subject to is the reaction of outside circumstances upon the nervous system, the digestive system, upon the sensory perceptions and the mental reflective organisms. All of these things mean that the body has to take a certain amount of abuse, and this has to be controlled as much as possible. Good example of our problem, a simple example today, is the fact that the average individual spends 2 to 4 hours a day viewing television. Now, television has a great many facets to it, but the problems that are most annoying in television, probably, are those which disturb and dramatize the emotions and reflexes and cause the individual to have powerful nerve reactions. Probably the most impressive of this group would be the horror and mystery story. The individual is constantly confronted with intentional efforts to stimulate the emotions. The sponsors like to see the emotions stimulated. The producer wants to see this. And most of the audience has become so accustomed to it that if the picture does not have these factors, they will turn it off. But these types of films and productions injure the psychic integration of the nervous system. They make it more difficult for the person to use energy constructively. He has to waste energy defending himself against illusions and fantasies. By the time he gets through with some of these delightful spectacles, he's worn out, tired out, fatigued, simply by the expenditure of energy. Energy used for any purpose must be conserved. Physical energy is a kind of basic utility, a basic form of life, which is not available to everyone equally. physical energy is something that must be conserved, used, and directed. The waste of it is the waste of life itself. And those who waste it continuously will find life is shortened, health is impaired, and the progress of the individual towards his higher objectives will be definitely damaged. So, we have to try to fight through this peculiar structure of body. I've noticed over a long period of time, and I guess many of you have had the same experience, that people trying to be good very often succeed in being obnoxious. Their virtues are not real. They attempt to frustrate something or to dominate someone else. And instead of learning to have a peaceful inner life, they become very sensitive and are annoyed by almost everything that happens. I know many cases in which the individual is suffering from morning till night from what he calls righteous indignation. The world becomes obnoxious to the person who is trying desperately to leave it. And as a result of that, his very process of staying here is made more obnoxious by his own reactions. The person who wants to really outgrow the body or transcend it must accomplish internal pleasantry. There must be a kindly, rather good-natured, relaxed attitude which permits the stomach to digest the food, permits the elimination to work properly, and also assists the biochemistry of the nutritional process in the human body. Everything that makes the individual angry, disgusted, mad, unhappy, unpleasant, revengeful, all of this type of emotion damages the chemistry of the human system. It makes it impossible for the person to digest the food properly. It results in all kinds of aches and pains, and a great many chronic ailments are nothing but chronic disposition that has set in to the degree that it has damaged the body. So with all the effort to be better people, to grow, to think, to be more enlightened, we must be sure to include the body in the plan. The body is something that is part of any plan we make, and we must never fail to give it that which is its proper due. To spoil the body is a mistake. To tyrannize it is equally dangerous. We must never allow it to rule us, but we must make our own discipline of it a very parental and not despotic. One way in which we try to conquer bodily problems is through the study of them. Anyone who has certain bodily problems will have some idea of these problems and perhaps a fair idea of why he has them. Most people who are not living well know why, but they prefer to ignore it. They wish to forget it and go on doing the things that please them. But to begin a plan, if you're going to hope to become a scholar, to become a mystic, to become a servant of public good, if you want to do something better than you've done in art or music or literature, you must take a very serious look at the body. Your purpose is not to rise above it in the sense of going against it, but rather rise above it in the sense of challenging it to be more of itself, to be better than it is, and not put in a position where it must fight back for survival. If you start with this, then you find that the Greeks were very much given to this thought, and so were most ancient peoples. Many of the philosophical schools of the Greeks were called gymnasium. And in Europe today, the middle schools are often referred to as the gymnasiums. The gymnasium in this case, from which we have merely a help procedure, included in old times and in Europe in many parts till today, the entire educational procedure. It's all exercise. It's all discipline, control, and direction of energy resources. The individual who jogs is in a gymnasium. So is the person studying Latin. Whatever use is made of energy, whatever organization is set up to enable the individual to achieve some definite purpose, this whole structure together is a gymnasium. It is a place where the mind, the emotions, and the body are trained together and become a part of a partnership and are not neglected, ignored, or variously outraged in the definite ambition to get somewhere. Particularly here in the West at the present time, where most success is measured in terms of money, we are annoyed by the fact that medical care is becoming more expensive. One of the reasons why it's becoming more expensive is because we are becoming more dependent upon it. And wherever you create a dependency, you subject yourself to exploitation of some kind. If the average person took fair care of themselves, there would not be this tremendous demand for medical assistance, and doctors would be satisfied to work more reasonably. But because they have created a massive profit system out of the human being's abuse of himself and neglect of others, he's in a position to charge anything he wants. But in the final analysis, the person trying to grow must start in by educating the various elements of his own nature. The Greeks, of course, held a great deal for calisthenics. They regarded a proper exercise as something that should be cultivated from the cradle. Now, exercise of a normal kind, as Socrates pointed out, must not be a technical boredom. Socrates said he was never able to exercise merely for the sake of exercising. He couldn't imagine anyone becoming interested in jogging around the block. The only reason that anyone does it is a desperate effort to be healthy. Now, the Greeks developed methods of exercise which were not so staid and unpleasant or unfulfilling. They lived in a world in which this tremendous involvement in industry and economics did not exist. They did not have to spend 8 to 9 hours a day at a desk. They did not have to do all the foolish and stupid things that we consider to be essential. Also, of course, they had no knowledge whatever of denatured foods. They ate the food that grew near to them, and it was never processed. They just lived naturally. It would be quite inconceivable to imagine a cat or a dog going out each morning and chinning the bar to keep its figure. It gets all the exercise it needs being itself. But when the individual as a human being has ceased to be himself and gives little or no attention to this phase of his personality, he has to manufacture all kinds of artificial ways of trying to do what he should do naturally. So it is very important to start in with a basic realization of values. Another very basic realization that the Greeks had, which we do not have, and that is that you do not build a reputation for excellence by wearing an expensive toga. You are not any better than you are. And there's no amount of decoration on the outside that will actually change the nature and substance of yourself. So the Greeks did not try to hide the imperfections of their bodies. They rather tried to live so that these imperfections would not develop. And where there were imperfections, they allowed them to be there. It is reported that Socrates was pigeon-chested. He may have been. But at the same time, he faced it, and his friends knew it. There was no effort to conceal it. He did not go into cosmetic surgery to take care of his pigeon chest. He accepted it, but he lived above it. And he lived so well that even with it, when he was called into the army as a soldier to defend the Greeks, when the enemy saw him standing in the field, armed and ready, they divided and went on each side of him. They had no intentions of facing him. So he came back a hero. But he also had trouble staying awake on sentry duty. So he said, this now becomes a discipline. So he practiced being a sentry, standing on only one foot. And he became so proficient at it that he could do 8 hours of sentry duty on one foot without even changing the feet. This was discipline. It was making something obey him. Generally speaking, most of the older peoples of the world live more naturally than we do. Ambitions were much less aggressive, and persons in various stratas of society expected to remain there. But because of the lack of false values, the lack of artificial activities, these people seemed to have done fairly well, and they had time enough to produce some exalted thinkers. During the age of Pericles, probably in Greece alone, had produced between four and six hundred very great intellects. During the age of Pericles, probably a half of the thinking of the world was done. Because these people, living naturally, having no false exaggerations to concern them, were able to settle down to use faculties instead of trying to repair abused ones. This is something we can't do entirely, but we should try to work on it a little. We should try to make sure that we are getting a maximum of constructive result from the efforts that we make to live. That what we are doing will always help, never hurt, the major projects of life. Of course, when someone asked, I think it was Aristippus, or one of the old Greeks, the greatest curse that would be imaginable, he said the greatest curse would be for a man to tell his son, live extravagantly. Luxury was the great curse. It still is. And it is because of luxury that most of the world's thinking is very badly done at the present time. We are not saving the energies. The body has them. It is born with them. With a little care, we can take care of them. But we cannot repair active wasting of energy on matters of no value. So we have to try to work with the body, realizing its potential, representing the facts of life to the body, and living accordingly ourselves. These procedures are of the greatest felicity to all concerned. Now, the body, as we study it, is a tremendously fascinating thing. It is a structure, it is a house that can restore itself. It is made up of brick and mortar and steel, all of it alive. And in it being a compound of constantly living elements, it is exceedingly responsive and reactive to the processes which take place within it. Now, over this body, as seated in authority, is something that in the thousands and millions of years of human evolution should be pretty smart, but isn't always that way. The human being today is equipped, if he wants to use the equipment, for a vast amount of self-improvement. He is capable of being more than he could ever have been before. And if we recognize evolution as a growing process and realize that we are progressing all the time, then at any given moment we should have available to us a wealth of previous experience. This may not be available in actual conscious thought, but it is available to us in instinct, in intuition, conscience, and many of those factors which tell us something of our own previous experiences with right and wrong. But the body being in the control of this other thing, this self, this mind, not only must obey, the body can't refuse to obey except at the cost of survival. But the human being can change its attitude toward the body at any time it wishes to. Buddha makes a very great and definite point out of this entire situation. To Buddha, the great enemy of mankind was the person living in a house but abusing it. The poor housekeeper, the housekeeper that allows the house to run down, is the offender. The house cannot help running down if no one takes care of it. The body might be able to continue to take care of itself if the mind did not decree that the body make mistakes, demand these mistakes, require the body to accept as natural things that no physical organism can support very long. So the Buddha points out very definitely that the tyrant is the mind. It is the mind that does it. It is the mind that is the slayer of the real, as we find in the Bhagavad Gita. The mind is the slayer of the body if we are not careful. Just as minds get together and create armies and kill each other, so the mind in man becomes a militant despot and destroys the very body that it depends upon. And in the course of this destruction, probably ruins its relationship with all outside factors of civilization and environment. So, we have to start at the bottom and build. One thing the person should do, begin with, is regulate life. Regulating life means to set up patterns that the person can perpetuate without constant breaking of these patterns. Food should be taken regularly, and it should be of a nature and quality that is suitable to the needs. The snack bar and all the odds and ends damage the body. The body should also rest at various times during the day. And persons beyond the age of 50 will find it very important to rest for a short time every day just to give the body a chance to reorganize its resources. I've told that to many people, and they usually say resting is a waste of time. It is not. The person who is tired and will not rest is the one who is wasting both time and life. Having set upon oneself the disciplines of things, we can be a little like the Zen monk who in the ashram, after he has finished his dinner, takes the plate that he ate from and puts it in water and washes it and then drinks the dishwater. That neats things up very much. But we have a lesson there which is purely Zen. Whatever we clean up, we have to drink the dishwater. It is part of the process of life. And some of the people have been very wise and thoughtful in their interpretation of these ancient fables. Having organized our resources in these details, we should go a little further to find out more about why we have the attitudes we do. Today, particularly, we are all becoming dominated by attitudes. And most attitudes that we're holding today are destructive. The attitude person is the one who has made up their mind before the evidence is even considered, and who finds everything to be what he expects it to be, because he rejects any other interpretation. Attitudes that are combative, attitudes that are self-centered, attitudes that are revengeful or despondent, morose, self-pitying, all these attitudes are very bad for the body. The body taking them on begins to lose certain functional processes. If you hold a mental dyspepsia long enough, it will become a physical dyspepsia, because the various processes of assimilation within the system are all symbolically set forth in the physical processes of digestion. So if we go along quietly, we start to be better people, by coming to terms with the body and recognizing it for what it is, a wonderful and useful friend, something we can depend on to give us terrific service if we will take care of it. But like an automobile that is neglected, it will not survive. Having made this basic arrangement, then we can more or less ask and receive the loyalty of the body. It is very difficult for a bad master to have loyal servants. A poor housekeeper will never win the loyalty of employees or persons who come in to do various things. You must respect, you must demonstrate an ability, an integrity, and a fairness in all procedures in order to demand or receive loyalty. The body will be loyal to the mind if the mind is thoughtful of the body. It is a two-way procedure. The body will react by greater efficiency, comfort, ease, and a surprising amount of reserve energy. But if the loyalty is missing, if the person has no interest in protecting the body, he's going to get in trouble, because he's going to do all kinds of things without any consideration for the effect of these things upon the human constitution. Wherever we depress our relationships with the body, we expose ourselves to epidemic ailments and to all kinds of definite infirmities. As we get along in life, we also have to make certain compromises with the body. The body begins to tell us it is a little more tired than it used to be, that it hasn't got quite as much energy as it once had, and though it is pretty effective and still quite good, you'll have to give a little more attention to it. It's just like working with a run-down old house. We may have kept it up very well, but as it gets older, it needs special attention, and you can't prevent a deterioration if that attention is not bestowed. So the body begins to need certain conservation processes. The very great mistake that has been made by a number of persons is to try to live young as far as the physical body is concerned, beyond the age when this is reasonable and probable or possible. The body cannot, by willpower alone, compensate for age. Some people are much more active in older years than others. But wherever the person reaches a maturity and older years, he must go into a strong, friendly relationship with the body.